Hi, this is Dr. Mike Chupp, and you are listening to CMDA Matters, the weekly podcast of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. Well, for this week's episode, we're doing something just a little bit different. We're sharing with you an episode that we originally aired back in March of 2021. You know, a whole lot has happened since then, but this particular episode is one of my favorites since we launched CMDA Matters back in early 2020. Our featured guest today is Dr. Carl Truman, who's the author of the book, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. Dr. Truman will be joining us actually in person as a plenary speaker at next week's 2022 CMDA National Convention, which is being held in Indianapolis, Indiana. That's right. After more than 2 years of gathering virtually due to the pandemic, we're finally returning to an in-person CMDA National Convention under the theme, Together Again. I really hope that I'll get to see you in person next week. I thought this would be a great opportunity to share this interview with you again in advance of our convention. Dr. Truman is a professor of biblical and religious studies at Grove City College in Pennsylvania and has been one of the most prolific and thoughtful writers and speakers in America over the last couple of years on the intersection of Christian thought as well as the sexual revolution. Because of the impact of the book Rise and Triumph, Dr. Truman just released a couple of months ago a more condensed and I think easier to read book from Crossway Publishing entitled Strange New World. Dr. Jeff Barrows, who's our CMDA Senior Vice President of Bioethics and Public Policy, joined me as co-host for this interview and asked Dr. Truman some great questions. So let's jump right into the conversation today. Well, I am incredibly excited to welcome to the program this week Dr. Carl Truman. He is professor of biblical and religious studies at Grove City College in Pennsylvania. He's an esteemed church historian and previously served as the William E. Simon Fellow in Religion and Public Life at Princeton University. He's authored and edited more than a dozen books, including The Creedal Imperative, Luther on the Christian Life, and Histories and Fallacies. He's a member of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. Welcome to CMDA Matters, and we're so happy to have The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self available to us in 2021.
It's great to be here, and thanks very much for your kind words of encouragement and kind words of welcome.
Can you talk just a little bit about how you came to decide to write this book?
Yeah, it was a slightly odd story in some ways. As you alluded to in your introduction, I'm really a Reformation / 17th century historian. Intellectual history of the Reformation, the post-Reformation is my primary field. But in my late 40s, I felt that I'd pretty much said everything of any use that I was ever going to say about that area, and there are plenty of other very talented, more talented than me, people working in that area. So I was looking for something new, and I was approached by Rod Dreher and Justin Taylor, the senior editor at Crossway Publishing, asking me if I would be willing to write a short introduction to the thought of Philip Reeve, the psychological sociologist. And I'd only barely touched on Reeve at that point. So I went away, got some Reeve books, started to read them, and realized that, yes, there was a project here, but also became convinced that a more interesting project would be applying Reeve to contemporary society. Around about the same time, the whole gay marriage thing was going down in the Supreme Court. That we had the bursting onto the scene of the transgender question in the form of Bruce, then Caitlyn Jenner. And that was raising, in my mind, a whole host of interesting cultural questions about how and why, particularly something such as transgenderism, can become plausible, not simply to academics in elite seminars at universities, but how the ordinary man and woman in the street are coming to buy into this ideology, coming to find this plausible. And so the initial project for a little book on Reeve expanded really into a major project trying to explain why the sexual revolution has taken the shape it has done, and how it has percolated down through society in a manner that affects the way that we all think. And I was privileged to be supported in this by Robbie George, Professor Robert George at Princeton University, who kindly granted me a year-long fellowship on his James Madison program at Princeton to work on the project. So I was able to draw on the collective wisdom of the other fellows that year in helping to shape and formulate the project.
Well, Dr. Truman, early in the book, you introduce a concept of two ways of looking at the world that I had never heard of before, and maybe in your circles it's very common, but it really struck me, and it also helped me to understand, or at least begin to understand, some of the things we're going to be talking about. And that's, I think you pronounce it mimesis and poiesis, and how it relates to a person's, the two ways to view the world. And I'd like you to kind of start this interview with kind of laying some of that foundation for our listeners that will help them kind of begin to understand what you're talking about in this book.
Yeah, the terms mimesis and poiesis, used particularly by the philosopher Charles Taylor, upon whom I draw extensively and very positively in the book, really to talk about, we might say, the way people imagine the world to be, or the way people intuitively connect to the world. And mimesis is really the idea that the world carries with it an intrinsic structure, an intrinsic authority to which we have to submit ourselves in order to flourish as human beings. And in the Middle Ages, this was relatively straightforward, because if you think, you know, my ancestors in England in the Middle Ages were almost certainly peasant farmers. And if you're a peasant farmer in 14th century England, you have to respect the structure of the world. You have to sow your seed at a certain time in the year. You're very dependent upon the weather for the prospering, the growing of what you plant. You have to harvest it at a certain time. You have to respect the rhythm of the seasons. And the world you live in is also very fixed. You don't have the opportunity for extensive travel. So you'd be born, baptized, grow up, get married, die and be buried, probably in the same village. And this really cultivates a view of the world that sees the world as having an authority and having a structure and an order to it, to which you have to conform yourself. What we see in the modern world, as the modern world emerges really from the 16th, 17th century onwards, is a shift to what Taylor calls poiesis, in contrast to mimesis, which is the idea, if you like, that we have to learn the patterns of the world and conform ourselves to them. Poiesis is the idea that actually the world is increasingly looked upon as just raw material that we can bend to our will. And when you think about farming, you know, in the 14th century, you could never have planted crops in the desert. But once you have the technology of irrigation, you can plant crops in the desert. Once you have fertilizers, then you're able to plant crops in soils that were previously barren. And when you think about other aspects of life, for example, industry rises. You know, if you have a printing press, then your livelihood's not so dependent upon the rhythm of the seasons as if you are a farmer. And so what has happened with the modern world is really, as technology has advanced and has given us a feeling of greater power over nature, then the idea that nature has a structure to which we need to conform ourselves has slowly but surely eroded. I won't say it's vanished completely. We're all aware that there are some aspects of nature to which we have to pay attention. We're talking in the middle of a COVID pandemic. Nature is kind of bitten back at this particular point. But on the whole, we tend to think of the world as really raw material over which we can impose our wills via technology. And that, I think, lies right at the heart of what it means to be a modern person. We intuitively think now of the world as being something that we can bend to our will, as having no intrinsic meaning, if you like, as something that we have to give meaning to through our will, through our technology. And that's a poietic view of the world, a world that rests upon a notion of poiesis, to use Taylor's term.
Freud's, most of his models, his theories have been debunked over the decades, and yet we find him still so influential in this modern self. How does that happen, that someone that most of his peers say, these things aren't reality, but we're going to hang on this social imaginary, it's still going to have impact?
Yeah, it's an interesting question about Freud. And I think the answer is a sort of twofold answer to that. The one side of it is some of what Freud says is actually true, and I think holds water. And secondly, a lot of what Freud says may not be true, but it's very appealing and we want it to be true. As to the first, I think Freud's great insight is that if you want to know what a society holds dear, look at what it forbids. Look at the things that are taboo in society. And of course, much of what society has forbidden over the years has been sexual. And I think that's true. If you look at societies that value the family have very strict rules on sexual behavior that protect the family structure. Now, what's interesting and what's perhaps disturbing on that front is the implication of what Freud says there is that when we reach a point where less and less is being forbidden, you're actually reaching a point where society is in some way starting to crumble or fall apart. And one of the worrying things about the sexual revolution is this wholesale overthrowing of traditional sexual morality must ultimately come with a social and cultural cost, because sexual taboos are central to holding society together. And I think on that front, that's what I positively use Freud, if you like. I think Freud is strong there. And I would say, when you look at the Bible, look at the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments are marked by what? Banning things, mm-hmm. telling you what you can't do,
taboos,
setting limits beyond which you must not pass. And when we move into a cultural moment as we are now, where the old taboos are being overthrown almost every week, I think we are justified in thinking that we are potentially heading into a time of great cultural instability. The second aspect of Freud is, I think when he tells us that we are fundamentally sexual beings and that our happiness is to be found in sexual satisfaction, that's kind of half true. Bottom line is, for most of us, our sexual desires are a strong part of who we are. And sexual activity does bring, as Freud points out, intense happiness, intense pleasure. And, nobody's ever lost money selling sex. A philosopher comes along and tells you, hey, the way for you to be really happy is for you to just let rip relative to your sexual desires and indulge them as much as you possibly can. That's a winning sales pitch. It's a winning sales pitch, I think. So I think part of the power of Freud is, yes, we know that things like the Oedipus complex, et cetera, the death drive, all of this stuff has now been, I think, debunked by and large. And Freud, certainly in the psychology classes at Grove, as far as I can make out, Freud is looked at in terms of a figure of historical interest, not a living influence on the discipline. But in terms of those basic ideas, I think they've made their way into that social imaginary we talked about last time. And they've done so because they appeal to us.
In terms of the sexual revolution, what do you believe to be the cause and what set these changes that we're seeing today in motion?
Yeah, the sexual revolution is interesting. And again, the temptation for Christians, of course, is to blame it on the 60s. Yeah, we tend to think of the sexual revolution as something that happened in the 60s, and therefore the 60s are to blame. And there's a lot of truth to that chronologically. The sexual revolution takes off in the 60s. But of course, the 60s didn't come out of nowhere. 60s were caused by the 50s, that were caused by the 40s, that were caused by the 30s, et cetera, et cetera. I would say that in Western culture, a series of key moves took place that led to the sexual revolution. Some of them are intellectual. And in the book, I really focus very much on the intellectual narrative. I think what you find in the late 17th and then on into the 18th century is an authorization of psychology. What I mean by psychology is the inner space of feeling for human beings, that the move is made there to saying, that which you are at a most fundamental level is your feelings. What you find then in the 19th century is that feelings are first of all detached from any moral framework by people like Nietzsche. Nietzsche essentially says, you know, there is no metaphysical moral structure to the universe to which we need to conform ourselves. Morality is a con trick played by the weak on the strong. Your feelings are just your feelings. They don't have any moral quality other than that. And then that's really picked up. We find a parallel in the scientific narrative with a man like Freud, who says, essentially says that it's correct that we are who we feel we are inside. But the sting in the tail is those desires, those feelings are fundamentally grounded in sexual desire. They're dark. Our inner space is a dark space of sexual desire. By doing that, Freud makes a key philosophical move in the understanding of sex. Sex moves from being an activity to being an identity. If you read the Bible, there's plenty of sex in the Bible. Some of it's considered legitimate, some of it's illegitimate, but it's always an activity. What you get with Freud is he's saying, you know, you are your desires. And as your desires are sexual desires, then you are your sexual desires. That really provides the framework for modern thinking, where people identify themselves as lesbian, gay, straight, bi, trans, et cetera, et cetera. Your desires become your identity at that point. As soon as you make that move, of course, sex is going to become political, because one of the central parts of legal codes throughout history has been the policing, the corralling, the restricting, the shaping of social sexual behavior. That's a basic element of society throughout the ages. So once you make sex identity, you make sexual codes political at that point. You make sex very political. So that's one aspect of the story that sets up for the sexual revolution. When you look at the rhetoric, for example, of the student rebellions of 1968, there's a lot of sexual rhetoric there. The student rebellions of 1968, you know, are often about sexual liberation. The liberation of human beings is the transgressing, the overthrowing of the old sexual codes. There's also a technological revolution. And this goes to that social imaginary issue we talked about a few moments ago. In order for something to become actual, it has to be possible and it has to be plausible. And the pill, of all things, above all things, the pill, and then at a later state, easy on-demand abortion, make the sexual revolution plausible, because there you can have sex with comparatively few social consequences, which was not the case throughout much of history. You think about it, you know, if you're a 19th century guy, you know, you're 19, 20, your hormones are raging, you know, you want to have sex with a woman, well, what do you got to do? You've got to get a job, you've got to be clean, you've got to prove to her parents that you have a future. If you mess around, you'll find that her father and her brothers come after you to teach you a lesson. You can't get away with breaking the sexual mores of your day. Come the 60s, none of those things apply. You can be a total loser by modern standards and still, you know, enjoy an active sexual life, because sex no longer carries the kind of consequences that it once did. So the sexual revolution is I think the confluence of technological developments and of philosophical developments coming together in explosive form in the 1960s.
Well, Dr. Truman, with all these changes that are going on with the sexual revolution, the things you've been talking about, one of the main issues I think that many of our members are facing, our students, our residents, even our graduate members, are struggling with how to talk to their colleagues about their own views on these things without going into or necessarily using biblical language. And I know you talk about the concept of embodiment in your book on several different ways. And I'd like to ask you if you feel that is a good language to be used with non-believers as a way to talk about issues like abortion, transgenderism, even end-of-life issues. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, it's an interesting question and a very difficult one. Uh, I, I think to some extent, you know, my focus is very much on getting Christian people to think clearly about these things at this point. You know, I'm not confident that Christians themselves really have a sound grasp on what the Christian position on embodiment would be. When I was pastoring for some years, an older pastor said to me, you know, do not assume that anyone under the age of 30 agrees with what you think is basic common sense about sex and embodiment. Well, that was 10 years ago. You can probably say now anybody under the age of 40 or 45, you can't make that assumption. So a lot of my thinking has really been done on getting Christians to wake up to the intuitions of the social imaginary that they may have imbibed without even thinking about it. How to talk to those outside the church on these things, how to talk to colleagues in the medical profession. That's an interesting and difficult question. I think I would, on one level, I'm looking at the book now on my bookshelf, I would recommend to any medical person that they get hold of Carter Sneed's book, What It Means to Be Human. She came out at about the same time as my own. He's a bioethicist, and he works there very much on the importance of embodiment for ethical understanding, and doesn't really use, you know, Carter is, I think he's a devout Catholic, but he doesn't use Christian language or theological language in that book. And he starts to work there from the idea of, well, whatever else we are bodies. And that means that whatever else we are dependent creatures. You know, Rousseau has this ridiculous statement that man is born free and everywhere is in chains. If ever a philosophical statement was so obviously untrue and yet has come to be so influential, that has to be it. Yeah, man is born incredibly dependent upon his parents, and we spend our lives pretty much dependent upon other people and on other bodies because of our own embodiment. And finally, at the end of life, we sort of revert to the same kind of bodily dependency we had at the start of life. So one way I think that to go about this would really be to try to get people to think about the importance of the body. I also think pointing people to the integrity of the body. I don't know if it's still the case, but it used to be the case that you could go to government medical websites and look at the various health conditions that afflicted active homosexual men because of the lifestyle in which they engaged. You know, one doesn't have to take a moral stand on those things to say, look, if you behave in a certain way, you're shortening your lifespan. You're doing damage to your physical body. You're making yourself incredibly vulnerable to these illnesses, this damage, which cannot possibly be part of your general thriving and flourishing. So that would be another thing that I would do. Is I don't know if those websites even exist on government sites anymore, but I'm sure that as medics, you'd be able to get hold of the statistics for that relatively easily. So I think a real emphasis upon the body and on the importance of the body. I do think on the transgender question, there's a sense in which it's going to be very difficult in the near future. On the transgender question, I am relatively optimistic in the long term on the grounds that because the bodies are so important, they cannot be gerrymandered willy-nilly, and nature will bite back. Tragically, there will be an awful lot of human suffering that takes place between now and the point when we see the tide turning. But again, I think a focus on the body, as you know, doing these things, the human body, messing with hormones, engaging in bodily mutilation, these things are ultimately futile and very, very damaging.
In the book, Dr. Truman, you point out that with expressive individualism, that there's a focus on today, pleasure today, being happy today, not thinking about the future so much. So you were mentioning that there is a little bit of hope in healthcare and with the body and with medicine because we can talk about what outcomes are. With what you have mentioned, that there is this temporal focus. We are brought up in our training, I'm a surgeon, Jeff, an OBGYN, to talk about what are the best chances for outcome here. And certainly on the transgender identity issue, it seems to me that that's where those of us who are courageous enough and willing to talk about it, that's where our focus needs to be. I think that's what you were referring to earlier, that outcomes, that we really care about human flourishing and good outcomes, though the definition of health and well-being, I think, has been manipulated, has it not, just a little bit in 2021?
Yes. And I think, you know, 2021 has been, I've seen the term apocalyptic used about the COVID situation by a number of Christian theologians, and using it in its technically correct sense, not in that it's a disaster, which it is, but in the sense that it is revealing. And, you know, COVID has been a very revealing moment for society as a whole, on the grounds that I think what's emerged has been we lack a moral hierarchy for ranking goods. I was very fortunate last year. My wife and I were very fortunate in that she was flagged as a potential as potentially having cancer at the start of the year. And thankfully, we were able to go through all of the procedures before everything closed down. What was interesting was she was told by her physician afterwards that if we hadn't got through the process by the time COVID became the only show in town, they would have assumed a worst case scenario and done some pretty drastic surgery in that case, which would actually have been completely pointless, as this was a false alarm. And that really got me thinking that, wow, we're in a situation where, you know, the only danger is the clear and present danger. The only good is immediate survival. The long-term effects of what we're doing relative to COVID are not being taken into account in terms of health policy at this particular point. And none of this is to say that drastic measures weren't necessary. It's just that there didn't seem to be any discussion or thinking or nuance relative to the drastic measures. So I think the whole notion of health seems to have become almost immediate survival slash doing things that make people feel safe, rather than thinking about, well, what are the long-term aggregate effects of the policies we are doing? What does this mean for long-term mental health? My mum is a widow, has hardly seen anybody for the last 12 months. It's had an effect on her. How does that play into our understanding? And again, you make the point at the start, expressive individualism will tend to collapse everything into the present moment, the needs of the present moment, the reassurance of the present moment. And I think we've seen that big time relative to the COVID crisis over the last year.
Well, as we conclude this week's interview, Dr. Truman, you conclude the book, and I will say I finished it a couple of days ago. It was a rather sobering conclusion. There were some bright spots and some not so bright spots. What hopeful things do you think readers can take away from your book after finishing this, which, I mean, to me, this is like a textbook. I would love to sit under your teaching for a whole semester on the rise and triumph of the modern self.
Well, thanks very much. For anybody who's interested in not reading the book, but getting a short version, Grove City College actually has 8 lectures of mine online that basically do a sort of sweep through the book. So you can save yourself all that reading if you want. I think, first of all, hope is not a strong suit in the book. I'm really wanting to give that analytical genealogy of where we are. And we're, you know, society is in a difficult place at the moment, and the church is in a difficult place. So I want people to be sobered up about what we're facing. I also want people to realize, you know, the church is likely to be shunted to the margins, at least for the rest of my lifetime, maybe for the next few centuries. Who knows? And that's a cause for lamentation. But it's not a cause for despair. And it's not a cause for despair for two reasons. One, there's the obvious reason. We have the promises. We know how history ends. The church wins. It may not be my denomination or my congregation or my generation that witnesses that. It may not be, you know, my nation that survives to see the church winning. But we know that the church wins. So in the long run, everything's going to be okay. Everything is okay. Death has already been overcome. In the more short term, though, I think that we need to avoid seeing marginalization as a complete disaster. Because one of the things that history teaches us is that groups shunted to the margins form strong communities and become powerful simply by virtue of being strong communities. If you think of the Jews in medieval Europe, they were marginalized. And yet the House of Rothschild becomes one of the most powerful banking institutions in Europe. Why? Because money lending was all they were allowed to do. And they became very good at it. and they looked after each other. They became very strong precisely through their marginalization. The Quakers were marginalized in England, and in the 19th century, they became powerhouses of the Industrial Revolution because it was all they were allowed to do. The LGBTQ movement is without doubt one of the strongest political lobbies and forces around today. How has it got that way? They were a true community. They look after each other. They were organized. They were intense. They were intentional. That's what the church should be. So I think if I was going to say, maybe it's not hope, but it's to say this, don't see our marginalization as a cause for despair. See it as an opportunity to regroup, rethink, and become strong again.
Well, you've taught this old surgeon a lot of new things. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Well, that conversation with Dr. Truman occurred more than a year ago. But listening to it again has made me even more excited to hear what he's going to be sharing with us at the CMDA National Convention. Again, that starts Thursday, April 21st in Indianapolis, Indiana. If you haven't yet registered, I have a suggestion for you. We're actually sold out for that in-person event, but there's still time for you to register to attend virtually. Without COVID-19, I wonder if we would have ever even thought about such an option. But now you can have access to all plenary and breakout sessions live, and you can chat live with other virtual attendees. In addition to Dr. Carl Truman, we will be joined this year by Lila Rose of Live Action Ministry, Dr. Daisy Dowell, who is Medical Director of the Lawndale Christian Health Center in Chicago, Illinois, and Mr. Dallas Jenkins, the creator of the Chosen TV series. You can visit natcon.cmda.org for more information and to register for the virtual option. We will have our CMDA bookstore set up at the convention, and many copies of Dr. Truman's 2019 book, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, will be for sale, as well as his brand new release, Strange New World, How Thinkers and Activists Redefined Identity and Sparked the Sexual Revolution. Dr. Truman has graciously offered to do a book signing for us after his plenary talk. And of course, you can also find both books online at cmda.org/bookstore. I do want to tell you about one additional upcoming event, and it's the return of our webinar series with the Hendricks Center at Dallas Theological Seminary. Would you join us on Thursday, May 5th at 12 p.m. Eastern Time for Engaging in Challenging Times with Dr. Daryl Bach and Dr. David Bolander as we explore how Christians in today's challenging culture can effectively engage and be God's light within the sphere of healthcare practice in our dark world today? Dr. Bach will initially unpack 6 key biblical passages on engagement, and he will challenge us to consider whether or not the church might just be a bit misdirected in some of our engagement approaches in the midst of current culture battles. Dr. Bolander will moderate and lead us through a time of Q&A, focusing on specific healthcare training and practice scenarios in which engagement is possible. I want to invite you to bring your questions to the discussion as we reflect on some of the harder realities that we face in healthcare as we practice in a pluralistic environment. If you'd like more information and to register, just visit cmda.org/DTSwebinar. As always, I want to remind you that you can suggest a future guest for this podcast. You can just email us at cmdamatters@cmda.org. And if you like our podcast, please be sure to give us a 5-star rating and share us on your favorite social media platform. By the way, if you are coming to our convention this year, I want to encourage you to take a few moments and share your personal CMDA story with us. Our podcast production team They're going to be there. And we want to hear how CMDA is making a difference in your life. All it takes, it'll just be a few minutes to meet with our team and share a few words. They'll make it so easy for you to share your testimony with us. And maybe your story will end up on a future episode of the podcast. I can't wait to hear how the Lord is using you right where you serve in healthcare today, bringing the hope and healing of Christ to our world through His disciples in healthcare. Well, it's the vision that matters most to us at CMDA and CMDA Matters. We'll see you next week, God willing.
This podcast has been a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on this podcast are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. CMDA is a nonpartisan organization that does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on this podcast reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members and are not intended to imply endorsement of any political party or candidate.